Session number 15587, Reel 3.
Mr. Boyd, Reel 3.
Yes, I fired a couple of Veery cartridges into the parachute in silk, which then did the trick. The aircraft started to burn, but unfortunately, due partly to the wind, which was blowing the flames away from the aircraft, and also the fact that there was practically no petrol on board, it didn't really burn as we would wished. But having started this fire, we then ran to the shelter of a little copse of trees, which was some 200 or 300 yards away, for cover. In due course, we saw the Germans arrive, a fire engine and two sort of staff cars. They quickly set about putting the fire out, and because, as I've said, it didn't get much of a hold, it's presumed, unfortunately, that they were able to get the film that we were taking. When they had gone, we decided to stay put until darkness, and then we'd make our way in a southwesterly direction towards Spain. Unfortunately, probably the after effects of what had happened, we both started shivering. Although it was a beautiful summer day, we were shivering, probably with shock. And we figured the best way to cure this was to get moving. So we broke cover and we went in a southwesterly direction. Unfortunately, although we had looked and listened, whilst we were crossing a road, a motorcycle and sidecar suddenly came round a corner, and the two occupants, the driver and the man in the sidecar, got out and covered us with rifles. As it happens, they weren't Germans, they were French. And we remonstrated them. My pilot, Peter, was quite a fair French linguist. And he remonstrated and said, look, you know, we're on the same side. You're French, we're English. So why are you stopping us? Why don't you let us go? And they said, look, sorry, we appreciate your point, but we have wives and families here. The Germans know you're here, and if we let you go, we're in trouble. So keep your hands up. They then handed us over to the German authorities, and we spent the night in the Châteauroux jail. The next day we were transported in a staff car to Paris, or the outskirts of Paris, which subsequently I cannot say, but I've been told probably was Fresnes prison. Had we known it at the time, we'd have been a bit unnerved, because that's where the spies went who were subsequently shot. However, we were only there overnight, and then we were taken by train to
Dulag Luft?
No. We were taken to Frankfurt on Main, I think it was, where we stayed overnight. We had to walk through the streets there, and it was only due to the exertions of our captors that some of the civilians were prevented from harming us. They obviously were very antagonistic towards RAF. From there we went to the sort of reception centre. And we were there some 3 or 4 days, where we were sorted out, numbered, photographed, etc., etc. And then we were sent to our various prisons. In my case, I went to Sagan, which has since become famous as the Wooden Horse Camp, and also the camp from which the Great Escape was made.
In the interrogation, what did they manage to get out of you?
Nothing really. They weren't very pressing, because they knew so much already. I was interrogated by a German major, and he said that they knew by virtue of the aircraft that we come from Benson, and he said we'd already given our names, of course, names and ranks. he said, he started asking questions about Benson and operations, etc., which, of course, we refused. You interrogated Singley, of course. And so you refused to give any information. He said, well, that's all right, old chap. He said, we know it anyway. He said, when did you last have ice cream with the Americans? At Mount Farm. You see, the Americans were running a similar photographic reconnaissance unit from Mount Farm, which was 2 or 3 miles away from Benson. And the Americans, as everyone knows, they're mad on ice cream. And even though there was a war on, the Americans had to have ice cream. And periodically, we from Benson were invited over to share the ice cream with them. Now, somehow or other, the German knew this. He asked me the question. As it happened, I'd never been to Mount Farm to have ice cream, but I knew that people did go. And it absolutely staggered me that he knew about it. But the interrogation didn't last very long because he obviously knew as much as I was able to tell him anyway. He knew that we operated from there, he knew we were flying mosquitoes, etc., etc. He probably knew as much or more about a mosquito than I could possibly tell him, and in any case he got ours to look at. So no, the interrogation wasn't very long or intensive. And certainly not abusive in any way. It was quite friendly.
When the German civilians showed hostility, what exactly were they doing? Were they trying to harm you?
Oh, yes. Yes. As I say, there was a German major and two other officers and equivalent to a sergeant, I suppose, escorting us. There were only about four of us at this time. And, as I say, but for them, I think we would have been set upon. They were hurling abuse and making gestures that, had they got us, I doubt if we'd survived. But we were protected by the German captors.
What were their gestures?
Well, arm raising, fist waving, catcalling, boos. All of it was in German language, of course. I had a smattering of German, which I'd learned at school, but beyond that, nothing. But it was obvious, even though I couldn't understand what they were saying, I knew what they meant.
Now, I interrupted you with you arriving at Stalag Luft 3, I think, at Sagen.
That was the last. That's as far as I'd got. I really forget how many people were there now. They were all RAF personnel, except one. The camp barber was a corporal in the army who'd been taken at Normandy, I think it was. And he, as I say, was with us as a barber in the camp. But other than that, they were all, if I say RAF, they were all officers of various services. I mean, there was RAF, there were some French officers there, all manner of Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, South African, some Norwegian, mainly RAF. A lot of the colonials were, in fact, a lot of Canadians were, in fact, although Canadians, they were in the RAF as opposed to the RCAF. And I understand that the whole activity of the camp, well, in fact, there were I think, four separate camps. They were all classified as Sagen, but there was East Camp, North Camp, and there were four. Mine was called Beleria. And before I got there, and after I was there, there was always this escaping activity, which in my own estimation was done threefold, partly to annoy the Germans and keep them on their toes and employ a lot of men looking after us to prevent escapes, partly to keep us busy, give us something to do, and partly because eventually, with any luck, there would be some escapes. I didn't get there until May, or even early June, I think. No, I got there 4 days before D-Day, so that would make it June the 2nd. And it was most odd, because here we were in a prison camp, and everyone was screaming questions at us about the Second Front, the invasion. And we knew nothing. We couldn't have been interrogated about it because we knew nothing. The fact that it was only 4 days away, we didn't know. It was kept so secret. So therefore, the fact that they were clamouring for news of it, we knew nothing, seemed a little odd, since we'd come from the place where the invasion was going to take place. However, the Great Escape, as it was called, took place, I think it was either end of March or April, from the camp at the Sagan that I went to, and where 50 officers were shot.
But this was before you arrived, I think.
Yes. Yes, some 2 months before I arrived. But I did see others shot. Not killed. Apart from any sporting activities that we were allowed to do in the compound, the day-to-day activity was walking round the camp, round the perimeter of the camp. And there was a wooden railing, and then a gap of about 15 feet. Then there was the main fence, barbed wire fence. And periodically, all round, were these sentry boxes, which we called goon boxes, with a sentry. And I remember on a Sunday morning, walking round on our activity, that's all, just walking round and round and round, and then we'd turn round and walk round the other way. And not far in front of me, there were two chaps walking, obviously engrossed in conversation, and one chap, as he walked, was just knocking against this railing, wooden railing. And suddenly shots ran out from one of these boxes and he'd lost 3 fingers. It was unnerving. It was terrible. And all the camp came out. They'd have lynched this chap if they could have got at him. But, of course, our own officers had to control them. There would have been mass murder if they'd have done anything, so they had to be controlled somehow. But it was so unnecessary and uncalled for. But really, having said that, that is the worst that I can record that happened whilst I was in Sagan. We managed to keep ourselves occupied. We did our own form of PT. As I say, the escaping activities never ceased. There was some sort of tunnelling going on the whole time. The only escape that was attempted whilst I was there was a solo escape. One of the Canadians in my room. In fact, he borrowed my boots because his were worn out. And he managed to clamber underneath. We had cesspits, and periodically they were cleared out. And when they did, we all evacuated to the far end of the camp, as you can imagine. And they were, these long sort of tanks were filled with this stuff, and then horse-drawn, and then they were laboriously taken out, and I don't know what they did with them, but they were emptied somewhere or other. And this Canadian somehow managed to get himself underneath this contraption. How he survived without dying from the smell, I'll never know. Anyway, he clung underneath this thing, and he actually got out of the camp. And he got some miles before he was recaptured. But that is the only escape attempt that was made whilst I was there. Although, let's say again, it's the only one I know about, because most of these escapes were kept secret, because what you didn't know, you couldn't tell. And most of them were only known by the escape committee and the persons who were going to escape. But to my knowledge, that's the only, from May onwards, that was the only attempt at escape. And we managed to survive. The Germans provided us with a certain amount, or should I say the Red Cross, I suppose, provided us with a certain amount of equipment, sports equipment, and footballs, American footballs, baseball bats, etc. And with these, and certain games that we organised ourselves, we kept ourselves reasonably fit. The rations were pretty low, but then we were assured repeatedly that the German populace got no more than that. We were getting as much as they did. So I suppose on that count we couldn't grumble. Added to which, we did get food parcels. When I say that, my wife sent me quite a number, and my mother sent me quite a number, which I never got. What happened to them, I'll never know. But a lot of chaps did get them, and the main supply came from America, American food parcels, which were excellent. And indeed, it was these parcels that were of great help in the escape activities, because a lot of the parcels contained tins of various things, and when the contents had been consumed, the tins were cleaned and manipulated, that is the word. There are a lot of clever chaps in you'd be surprised how people can turn their hand to things. And they made air ducts, which were put down the tunnels for air while they were digging. We made, one man, yes, I have to say that, one man made, a Dutchman, made himself a suitcase from tins. It was marvellous. And I'll come to that later. Anyway, we passed it, but then came the winter, and I don't really think I've ever been quite so cold in my life. It really was cold. And we were 18 to a room in those days, and we each had certain duties, one of which was to wash up, and we had a cloth with which we washed up. And that cloth, if left on the board, on the table, next morning will be rigid with cold, frost, ice. There was just one burner, stove, I suppose is the word, with a flue that went through the ceiling. And we had a limited amount of coal to use on it. And the fact that it was excessively cold, we got no more. We just got the same amount, day by day by day. And so, yes, it was pretty cold, and most of us slept in our clothing all night. We had Christmas there. I'll never forget that Christmas. Some of the chaps were so clever at what they did to try to ensure that we had Christmas festivities. They even drew up a Christmas menu, and by dint of saving certain things from the American parcels, we had actually had a so-called Christmas lunch, which basically, the meat content was Spam. We did have Christmas pudding, because some were sent in the parcels, so we did have a little bit of Christmas pudding. There was one incident which I also have to report, that early in my captivity, the Germans found out that we were using certain items in the food parcels. Firstly, the tins, of course, as I mentioned, also some of the contents. They used to send us prunes, packets of prunes. But then some of the brighter sparks found that they could use these and make wine. And it was a funny thing to see drunken POWs staggering about. Anyway, the Germans put a stop to that, and they were very vicious about it. This time they said, right, Food parcels are ready. Bring buckets with you. Well, this, of course, we'd never done. You'd go down and collect your food parcels and take them back to your room. On this occasion, we had to take buckets. And what they had done, they'd opened every food parcel, they'd emptied every tin, undone every tin, and packet, and they emptied the whole lot into the bucket. Sugar, jam, spam, cigarettes, coffee, tea, all in the same bucket. So they could not be accused of not giving us the food parcels, but they were intent on making sure that we didn't use them wrongly. I suppose you can't blame them for that. Anyway, this lasted for about a week, and then in the end the camp commandant, our SBO, senior British officer, as he was called, managed to have talks with them, and we got back to having our parcels again. Night time, periodically we'd hear bomber forces going over, bombing somewhere or other. In those days, of course, we were at Sargon. We were, there was really nowhere near us that required bombing, so we didn't. We'd see them going over in the daytime. We'd see them going, hear them going over at night, rather. But they didn't bomb near us at that point. Similarly, during the daytime, we'd see trails of squadrons of fortresses going over. Occasionally, we'd see a bit of a dogfight when they were attacked by fighters. Ah, now, where was that? Yes, that was at Sargon. Not far from Sargon, there was a German Air Force station. And when we were shot down, there was no such thing as jet-propelled aircraft. And this was our introduction. This particular German Air Force station had got some jet-propelled aircraft, and they were learning how to fly them. And knowing that we were a POW camp, they'd come and annoy us by zooming low, dive-bombing us, as it were, playfully. So as a crowd, we went out and we sort of indicated, rubbish, rubbish, get down really low. And happily to say, one crashed. He came a bit too low. So shall we say we enticed one down instead of shot him down. There's not much more I can say about that, except that then, of course, in January, I can't give the date, but not long after Christmas, mid-January, when the Russians were getting a bit too close for comfort, we were forced to march westward. The whole camp went. Now, when these parcels arrived, they came in boxes, sort of, I think it was 3-ply boxes. And some of our chaps were clever, they turned those boxes into armchairs. So that every mess, as we called them, but every hut had a couple or three of these armchairs to sit in. And they were so made that at the bottom they were on sort of sledge runs, which were very useful because there was a terrific snowfall. Oh, it was a couple of feet deep, I would think. I forget whether it was over Christmas or immediately after, but all I do know is that when we were told to move, there was about a couple of feet of snow on the ground and it was still snowing. So what we did, we piled our belongings onto these, what we called sledges then. We got some means of harnessing and we pulled these over the snow, which was fairly easy because of these runners. That was okay for the first 2 days. Then came the thaw, and the countryside was littered with sledges because the snow went. And we had to abandon most of our personal equipment because we couldn't possibly carry it. And that's where I'll refer again to this Dutchman with his case, because he had his case on one of these sledges, but having to abandon the sledge, he had to abandon his case with it. He was heartbroken. So somebody found a metal suitcase which he left behind. His name was Dan Brand, a Dutchman. And we marched for, oh, I don't know, A week, 10 days maybe. When I say marched, it was a slow trek. And we finished at a place called Luckenwalde, not to be confused with Buchenwald, of course. Luckenwalde was perhaps 10 miles south of Berlin. And I don't know how big the camp had intended to be, how many it was intended to house, but all I do know, I was told that there were three times the number in there that there should have been. And I think there were probably practically every nationality in the world. All the Commonwealth, French, Russians, you name it, they were there. Most of them, unkempt, unshaven, ill-clothed, dirty. And we started off at Sagan in 12 to a room. By the time I left, we were 18 to a room, but here we were herded, about 50 in a sort of, it wasn't a room at all, but anyway. And that would be towards the end of January or February. So we must have been there about a month. Anyway, eventually one Sunday morning, we were awakened by this peculiar noise. Never heard anything like it before, a sort of almost like thunder, a rumbling which got louder and louder. And it turned out to be Russian tanks that had arrived on the scene. And the camp was divided into different compounds with main roads running in various directions. And these tanks came down the main roads and then they veered off and they just aimed themselves at the posts which were supporting the barbed wire and mowed them all down. And they turned round and came back and mowed those down. And then the Russian commander appeared, contacted our commander. Oh, I must say before this, yes, I've forgotten that fact. We had some inkling that this was going to happen because 2 or 3 days before this happened, the local mayor or whatever he was called of the local town at Sagan appeared, had words with our camp, SBO, took the key of the camp off his head, which was with a piece of string or something, and handed it to him and said, "We are surrendering to you." Well, it was made quite clear to him that there's no question of surrendering to us. We were non-combatants at that stage, we were POWs. So there's no way that we could accept his surrender. He'd have to go and surrender to somebody else, which they didn't want to do because that would mean surrendering to the Russians. He thought by surrendering to us it would ensure his safety. Anyway, that was something that came before the other. I'd forgotten that bit.
He was a Bürgermeister of Luckenwalde.
This was, let me see, where was this? That would have been Luckenwalde, yes, not Sagan, Luckenwalde. And then, as I say, some 2 or 3 days after that, these tanks arrived. And having had a long conversation with our SBO,